Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm just waiting for a few more people to come in and join in, and then I'll get started and introduce our guest for today. So I'll just go silent again for about one more minute, and then we'll get started. Thank you for coming. Okay, welcome everybody to today's BIPs webinar, which is being very kindly given by Katie Campbell, and it's on an archaeological perspective on the Mongol conquest of Central Asia. So we're really looking forward to hearing from Katie, and welcome Katie, there she is. I've got a couple of pre-talk slides just to go through with you, so we'll go on to the next slide. I've just got a tiny bit of news to give you about some upcoming events. So the next webinar that we'll be having next month in May will be happening on a Thursday on the 14th of May at 5 p.m. Same place, just different day of the week. And that will be given by Lardan Nushin on Peering Through the Cracks, Polish Musicians in Tehran, 1942 to 1945. So we're very excited about that. And it's actually a very different kind of topic from today's talk. So it's great. It shows the breadth of Persian studies as a field. And another piece of news just to give you all is in case you're interested in applying for a travel research or research assistant grant from BIPs, the deadline is coming up in just over a month on the 18th of May. And if you just want to be kept informed of all of this kind of news, these are all of our social media sites, and there's our website is there at the bottom, bips.ac.uk, and you can find us on all of those: LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, X, and Facebook. And just to put this out there so everyone can see, just to know what our policy is for events, just to make sure that we're all, I'm sure we will be, and we're only talking about archaeology, so it shouldn't be, hopefully it's not, I don't know, maybe it's very contentious. But yeah, just to all be kind and considerate in the questions. There'll be an opportunity once Katie's given her talk, you can write questions into the box at the bottom of the Zoom box there. And so we'll try and get through as many of those questions as we can at the end. It just depends on time whether we get through all of those. But yeah, do ask at the end if you have any, and I'll be reading those out. Oh, and someone's already made a comment that the events I've mentioned are not on the website. I think the hopefully the grant applications are on the website already. The next month talk by Lardan Nushin is not quite up yet because we've only just recently in the last few days finalized that, but it will be put out, and please do share with your networks and pass on the news of that talk once it is posted. It should hopefully be there by the end of this week, but thanks for pointing that out. So that's me introducing. I just want to tell you a bit about our speaker today before I hand the floor over to Katie. So Katie is an archaeologist, and she studied history and archaeology at Exeter University, and she's worked all across Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia. And she completed her DPhil in archaeology at the University of Oxford. And she's currently based at the other Oxford institution at the University of Cambridge at King's College, Cambridge, working as a research fellow there. And she's looking at broader changes in urban sites in Central Asia and the Caucasus from the 11th to the 15th centuries. And this is really where this piece of work that she's talking to us about today is situated. So can't wait to hear what you have to tell us, Katie, and I shall hide myself and hand over to you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much, Eva-Lola, and to BIPs for hosting this event and indeed funding some of the research that you're going to hear about today. So it's really nice to speak to you all this evening, afternoon, morning, wherever you are in the world. Hopefully you can see my presentation now, and it's the full screen. Shout if you can't, I guess. And I'm gonna talk about some work that formed a bit of my PhD, which is gonna come out as a book, I hope quite soon, and some more recent work I've done at least one of the sites I'm talking about, the site of Otrar in southern Kazakhstan, and then a little bit more about some reading I've been doing of published works and looking at legacy data to try and understand what happened, I guess, in the early 13th century in that kind of most evocative moment when the Mongols conquered Central Asia and indeed much more besides. So I suppose I want to persuade you, if you're a historian or if you're an anthropologist or a general interest in the Mongol conquest, that archaeological remains are a sort of massive underused archives that we can interrogate to understand the Mongol conquest and indeed Mongol rule in some of these cities, especially because the cities of Central Asia are often in quite arid landscapes, they're often completely abandoned. And so we have the amazing fortune in many places to be able to choose where we want to excavate, which we might not be able to do if we were looking at a city that was still occupied today, because people don't tend to like you coming and digging up under their houses or in their gardens. The issues remain to think about, if you like, a historical question, which I think the Mongol conquest in many ways is. To try and get really precise dating to be able to hang some of the archaeological evidence that we get from these sites onto the historical events that we can read about, you know, often in quite great detail in the surviving written sources, but also how these can kind of complement, perhaps challenge, and certainly maybe provide future directions for research. That maybe wouldn't be evident from the written sources. There's also an issue with the complexity of some of these sites. They're often occupied for thousands of years, or 1,000+ years, and therefore trying to find the specific part of the site and the period that you're interested in is often a challenge because you're looking at hundreds, if not thousands, hectares of material and a significant depth of archaeological deposits. There's also questions as to the reliability of some excavations, and I think that can only really be broached by people being really open about their data, how they collected it, and where it's kind of archived so people can go and check. Also want to think a little bit about the different scales of interrogation. So we're talking about such a massive event, the Mongol conquest, and you can look at that from an archaeological perspective, looking at a single building and what happened to that over the period, you know, from the early 13th century to the later 13th century, perhaps. You could look at a whole neighborhood, or you might be able to actually get enough information from individual cities to be able to compare across a much wider kind of landscape or region. So just to sort of give a brief geographical outline of what happened. We're talking about, as I mentioned, the early 13th century, so the early 1200s. And the particular conquest I'm interested in is the one that is coming over into this region, what is now modern day southern Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, that kind of region. And you can see from this map the dates that we're talking about, so 1219 to 1221. Is the initial conquest, if you like, the movement of Chinggis Khan and his armies from Karakorum, sort of central Mongolia, Orkhon Valley, and surrounds over into the arid area, the oasis cities of Central Asia. Another thing to note from this map that is interesting to think about when we're talking about Central Asia is that we have the Khanates that form from the United Mongol Empire. So by about the 1250s, after probably some decades of instability, these three different political units, if you like, polities, the Chagatai Khanate, the Golden Horde, and Ilkhan Empire, the Ilkhanate, all kind of coalesce on this zone that I'm thinking about today. And actually, I'm going to look at three different cities. One is in the Chagatai, and one is in Golden Horde, and one's in the Ilkhan Empire. And we might think about how those differ, the sort of differing roots of those three different polities over time. If we think about the historical sources, I'm not going to give too much on this, but just to sort of remind ourselves what is reported to have happened during the Mongol conquests. Typically, there's a lot of narratives of destruction, so citadels and defensive walls being leveled or destroyed, a lot of enslavement of people, so artisans being taken away, perhaps craftspeople into slavery, but also to serve in the levy, to serve in the armies, and also widespread massacres are reported in many cities in Central Asia, in the orders of sort of tens of thousands of people, if not potentially hundreds of thousands. They do often seem quite, I suppose, sometimes formulaic, the descriptions of these great kings when the Mongols arrive at your city wall and they, try and besiege it. But I think there was some level of negotiation there as well. So if you didn't try to fight the Mongols, often they would let you pay a tax rather than having your entire population enslaved or slaughtered. But there was certainly a big shock to demographics, the demographics of the region. And you can see a long list of cities here across Afghanistan, Central Asia, across Iran and into the Caucasus, where this event had an impact, I guess, on them and has been recorded by later historians. So just to underline the key themes here, we have comprehensive destruction, which seems to be unstable for this region for several decades. We have a movement of peoples in great numbers, so people conscripted into the Mongol armies. We have labor reportedly moving into depopulated regions to help harvest, for example. And we also probably have a lot of people fleeing in advance of the Mongols. And this is a sort of, it's not a single event. It causes instability for a while. But recent reassessments here, I've got George Lane, who was at SOAS, and Charles Melville, who's well known to BIPs, I'm sure, just sort of questioning slightly how seriously, we should take some of the numbers, some of the logistics, if you like. And there's also historical literature suggesting that I know Deborah Torr has written about this, and Charles Melville as well has also written chapters about Khorasan and Central Asia perhaps being weakened in the period before the Mongol conquests. And from an archaeological perspective, I was really interested to try and look at some of the cities to find out what these really evocative accounts might look like in terms of the story on the ground, if you like. And I was quite taken that actually in most of the archaeological reports I was reading from this region, there weren't mass graves. There didn't seem to be enormous destruction, or if there was reported destruction, you could kind of explain it away with perhaps other things, an incidental fire. Or indeed a building that was reported destroyed that was still standing today. However, there is archaeological evidence of Mongol massacre, violence, and destruction. The best example I think I found is at the site of Yaroslavl, near to Moscow, where there was a massacre nearby Russian terms. I think it's a few hundred kilometers, but a massacre in 1238, recorded in the local chronicles. And this site was actually found by chance during the renovation of the city centre. And this site for archaeologists is kind of fantastic because the dating is very good, because the houses there were built from wood, and therefore you can use tree ring dating, dendrochronology, to get the exact year that the tree that was used to construct houses was cut down. And I believe that gave a date, a sort of earliest date of the 1220s and a later date of sometime in the 1240s for the reconstruction of the city. So this was a wooden city that was predominantly burnt at some point in that kind of 20-year window. And among the ruins of the city were found mass graves of people that had often died in quite violent and unpleasant ways. So here we have a couple of the skulls that were found in this at this site, and one of them has a substantial hole in its the front of its head, which when the osteologists studied it, could tell that that was coming from a blunt instrument, probably some kind of club, being having downward pressure, so quite possibly from someone on a horse or someone who's higher than the person who's being unfortunately hit. And then there was also blade trauma. So in this one, you can see a sort of sword blade or something has gone right through the skull, and you can kind of imagine that also could have come from a horse, as the authors suggest here. There's also some pretty interesting information that can be gleaned from this site, in that some of the bodies and the clothes were so well preserved because of the frost and the damp, if you like. They didn't degrade, so they actually found there was some of them were still wearing the remains of the winter clothes of furs. And this massacre is meant to have happened in February, so this pointed more and more to this being that 1238 event. And this, I suspect, is what we might expect to see based on the written sources in Central Asia. But as I'm going to sort of describe, actually the picture maybe looks a little bit different to that. So the three cities we're going to talk about today are Otrar here in the Syrdarya. So this is on the route that comes from Fergana through Tashkent and up down the valley here into the Aral Sea, or what's left of it, if you like. Konya-Ergench, which was a really important city, the capital at points of the Khwarezm, certainly the heartland of the Khwarezmian Empire, who ruled this area before the Mongols arrived, the Khwarezm Shah. And Merv, which is down on the Mugab Delta here, which was a very well-known, populous, economically very valuable city in that pre-Mongol period, so particularly in the mid the 12th century, in the middle of the 12th century. Otrar, here's a picture of it here, so here's a sort of a Google Earth view of it and an aerial image that we've taken during our excavations, is a large city. It's about 170 hectares in total, and it's got a sort of a fortified shahristan, or walled inner city, and then a suburban rabat. So this is the area here. You can see in the protected zone, you can just about see the fence line where the agricultural zone ends. It's got two reservoirs here, and probably a third one over here, which would have stored water from the city, and it's on a tributary of the Syrdarya, where a canal is running off. You can just about see the canal running through here to irrigate the surrounding suburban area and provide clean drinking water to the city. In terms of the layout of the city and what was occupied when the Mongols would have first arrived in 1219, or when their envoys were sent, trade envoys were sent in 1218. As far as we can tell from our excavations, we think that before the Mongol conquest, so about the 11th, 12th century, the northern part of the suburb was quite densely occupied, maybe not occupied, but there was a lot of activity going on in there. Whereas in the south, we have sort of later things going. And the mound is 18 to 20 meters tall. So we have layer upon layer of mud brick architecture basically forming this large mound. I have a really fantastic team who are Kazakh, Georgian, and British. And Carl is American, actually. So we have British, American, and Kazakh, Georgian. And we together have excavated around 40 trenches. You can see these red marks we've put on the map. And we've been targeting places we think there's significant occupation. So sort of mounds like this in the suburb. We've reinvestigated trenches that have been previously dug on the Shahristan. And that's because we don't want to start fresh on here because the city was occupied until the 18th century. And so we'd have to dig several meters before we could get to that Mongol period horizon, the layers that would tell us what happened during that period. And we've also been looking at the defences systems here as well. And it looks like the defences are in the northern part of the city are built probably in about the 11th or more likely 12th century, which is quite interesting. And the southern part is probably defended by the water, by these reservoirs and sort of lower land. So yeah, as I mentioned, the broad trend of occupation we found from all these trenches and looking at the sort of materials getting radiocarbon dates and pottery from them is that in the northern Rabat we have this intensive occupation up till the 12th century. Unclear whether it actually continues up to the Mongol conquest, which is interesting. I'm waiting for some radiocarbon dates to get a better sense of that because the pottery actually looks like it might be a bit earlier than the immediate pre-Mongol period. The Shahristan is pretty much continually occupied, although we'll see in a second that actually there might be more to it than that. And then in the southern Rabat, this green area here, we have really intensive occupation everywhere we look in the 14th and 15th century, and relatively less in the, from that earlier period. But as you can see from our dots, our red dots behind here, we haven't dug everywhere. So this is a sort of a rough overview based on the trenches we've excavated. It's entirely possible that there might be something there that we just haven't put a trench in yet. But I'm just going to revisit something that was one of the big findings from my PhD research, just to explain why I'm so interested in Otrar and the sort of discrepancies between the written accounts and the archaeological remains. We revisited, or I revisited in sort of 2018, this trench, which you can see is quite deep. You can see it's sort of marked from the elevation model. It's a darker color, so it's lower. It's a deep trench, and that was excavated primarily in the 1980s. With further work done slightly more recently to present it to the public, I think in the sort of 2010s. But the excellent book published by the three archaeologists, Akishev, by Pakov and Yerzykovich in 1987, which looked at Otrar between the 13th and the 15th centuries, focused a lot on this excavation area. And it surmised that there was a pre-Mongol architectural horizon here. And then there was a later post-Mongol conquest at some point. They weren't entirely sure how many decades or whether even a century had passed before the city was rebuilt. But what they did say was there was a whole layer or up to a meter of remained sort of a layer of abandonment. So there was no mud brick architecture in there. And that the street pattern from the pre-Mongol buildings had changed by the time the dense housing in the street, as you can see here, was rebuilt in that post-Mongol period. So what I wanted to do was dig a hole at the edge of that trench and clean it up and try and record the specific layers they were referring to. And I relatively quickly from their plans Identified where the horizon for architecture was, that post-Mongol conquest, so probably later 13th or maybe 14th century architecture was, and that earlier pre-Mongols, so we're talking pre-1219 effectively, architecture would be, and then how long this abandonment might have lasted for. And from those layers, I collected a variety of different seeds, about which I think I could almost give a whole separate talk on the botany, and we're getting some pollen analysis done. It's going to be quite interesting, I hope, to try and get some precise radiocarbon dating from those different horizons. And seeds are really good to date because they grow in 1 year and they die that same year. So unlike dating a piece of charcoal, which could be from a tree that is sort of several hundred years old or has been you know, in someone's roof for 100 years before it gets burnt, these should give us a fairly decent precise result. And these are the results that I got. So that pre-Mongol, so it should be finishing about here in 1219, actually that abandonment, well, the use of that horizon seems to be finishing in about the 1150s, or by the 1150s. It could well be being used quite a bit earlier. And then the abandonment layer that's building up almost up to a meter is in a pretty similar period. The whole Mongol period, there's nothing, unfortunately, for me and my interest in the Mongol conquest. And then the rebuilt horizon is in the 15th century. So there's a big gap there where the Mongol should be. And when I looked at the pottery and the coins, I mean, the coins are a bit more complicated because there's quite a lot of coins from hordes, which sort of change things, but there's not Mongol activity, at least in that part of the city. And I'll return to this in a bit, but this is a paper that was published actually in 2020, not long before I finished my doctorate and submitted it. And it basically found something remarkably similar, that the canals in the Otrar Oasis, this is published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, if you'd like to find it, 2020, actually were drying up around the same time as I was finding, sometime in the 12th century, not actually in that later 13th century period. So it looks like something's going on demographically, hydrographically, unclear exactly what. And so we've been excavating canals, actually, this was last year in 2025, about this time last year, and we've been taking these cores to try and get pollen from, to see if the vegetation, to see if it's drying up, or to see if it's actually depopulation. So I'm going to move now down to Mer. And if we have time, I'll talk a bit more about the canals. Move down to Merv here. So we're down now in Khorasan, so a slightly different region environmentally, and also sort of much further from the steppe proper, if you like, probably much more tied into the sort of southern Iranian and Afghan and dances in India, this sort of region, as opposed to Otrar, which was probably looking more towards the steppe and northeast towards Mongolia and China, if you like. So this is just to show you a overview of the city to show you what it looks like today. And as you can see, completely abandoned, a very large city. If you look at the scale, that's 2 kilometres. So it's 2 kilometres across, just about, very large population. I'm sure if you've been coming to BIPS lectures, I'm sure you'd have heard from Tim Williams or maybe even Georgina Herman about Merv. So I'm not going to go too much into it. But just to say that this large city here, this sort of egg-shaped one, the square one with the two suburbs, was the city that was occupied when the Mongols arrived. And so we're talking 1221 now, I think it's meant to be February 1221, the Mongols sack Merv, having previously tried to do a deal with them, if I understand correctly from the historical sources. And you can really see here this 8th till approximately 13th century city, probably a bit later, because the latest city here, which was founded in the 15th century, You can immediately visually see the enormous change in the size of the city here. So from this really large territory here down to this much smaller one, and that's a later extension here. So that's Abdullah Khan Kala, and then a later extension there. So that's 15th century there, and that's 12th, 13th century here. So that's visually quite striking. And actually, a walkover survey done by David Gilbert, who I think is now based in Cardiff, sort of showed the shrinking of the occupation area in the late 90s and early 2000s. Although I think a lot of pottery surveys had happened already, so I think this data is sort of a good visualization, if not the absolute last word in what's going on in terms of the occupation. I'm sure if you were to excavate, you might find something slightly different. But you can see from that's the egg-shaped city. That's the centre of it. So we've got continued activity in the 15th century right in the centre. We've got a kind of way going through that seems to still be in use. And just note that the occupation is still quite strong in the south, in the southern suburb of the city. And this is a collation of the sort of Yutaki, which is the Soviet era archaeological expedition to Merv, well, to the whole of southern Turkmenistan, and Merv was one of the sites they did a lot of work at. And I'm just marking a few things here where Svetlana Lunina, who was one of the archaeologists who worked extensively at Merv, became really well acquainted with all the material from there, made some observations here from her work in the sort of 50s and 60s into the 70s, that the potter's quarter here in the western suburbs was slowly being abandoned in the 12th century. And there were industrial dumps that predated the Mughal conquest already coming into the city. So we might be seeing a decline similar to in Otrar here. And I think if you look at historical sources, I'm at a conference at the moment with a lot of historians, and they were saying, yes, if you look at historical sources, you also do get a few clues that this might be the case. Merv, as far as we know, continued in some way. It wasn't completely abandoned after the Mughal conquest, and it seems to have become an important centre for kind of religious pilgrimage. A lot of the shrines survive today. They've been sort of conserved in a fairly, I guess, harsh way in some cases, but the shrines here, you can see this one from the 70s. There's continued activity even today. I think if you go to Merv, you'll see people at the Mausoleum of Sultan Sanjar in the centre, and a lot of people visiting these shrines. And I think these remain the focus for a lot of the activity in the city. But this is an excavation that we did a very long time ago now. I think it was about 2012 or something, or 2011, of a trench that had been previously excavated, and we excavated sort of alongside it to try and get some dating material. This is part of the UCL Ancient Merv project led by Tim Williams, where we found a lot of small structures, not quite the monumental structures we maybe expect, that you can see from this lovely brick herringbone pattern courtyard here. So you can see this little hints of the earlier, probably pre-Mongol architecture, and then these smaller structures often made from reused material here. We've got some lovely pottery from the Mongol period here with a beautiful fish. That's a kind of very Chinese style, or Chinese to me style, fishtail painted along the rim of the shed there. But this does sort of suggest very much an urban decline, if not a complete abandonment. So there's certainly a big impact on Merv from the Mongol conquest. But there's a good chance, I think, that maybe started before the Mongols arrived, actually. Here's just some more pottery that's been found kind of in and around Merv from the Mongol period, and really actually quite later, just showing that there's continued interest in the site. But what was, I suppose, particularly interesting to me after this real narrative of destruction was that there was a Buddhist shrine constructed in Merv in the 1240s. There's one or two references to it in historical sources. And Galina Pugachenkova excavated this in the 1950s and has published a very short piece on it, just to sort of show its main features. So this is the planet. It's not very large. You can see that's a 5 meter scale there. So it's a pretty small shrine. But what the excavators described was that there was extensive ceramic decoration. This is a drawing reconstruction again by Pugachenkova, showing the really quite local style of decoration, but actually twinned with a very Mongol aesthetic, if you like. So if you go to Karakorum, this is actually from Xi'an, but Karakorum, you would see very similar style roofs on their Buddhist monuments there. And I was delighted to visit last year, first time to Mongolia, and see a lot of sherds like this roof tile, which was from that shrine in Merv. And it's possible that you know, Mongols are bringing, or someone is bringing, building material, perhaps even all the way from Karakorum, to construct this really striking building in Merv. This is one of those tiles. That's a kind of decorative end tile there, and this is something that I'm not really sure what it is, but it did make me wonder if perhaps, you know, animal, you know, an animal adornment, maybe something architectural. It's really large. I should have put a scale on, I'm afraid I don't, but it almost looks like a kind of water downpipe. I mean, it may be a very large vessel. I know it resembles vessels from the period, but I thought I'd include it as part of this interesting assemblage. So moving on to Konya Genç, which, so moving swiftly on, sorry, it's a bit of a swift move, but we're now going up to Konya Genç in Khwarezm. So it's in modern day Turkmenistan, very close to the Uzbek border. And this was the capital for the Khwarezm Shah, or they sort of flirted with Samarkand and Bukhara, I think, a bit, but this was the kind of spiritual heartland, really the capital of their empire. And they're from Khwarezm. This is their main city. And this is a plan I've taken from an article by Golombek, and you can see it's after Mamedov and Muradov, who've published a nice book on Konya Genç. And you can see here again with the scale, we're looking at a pretty large city, maybe not quite as large as Merv, but, you know, substantial. And when the Mongols arrived in 1220, I think the city eventually fell in the spring of 1221. This was the main kind of fortified central area called Tashkala. And we'll briefly have a look at a couple of the monuments that have been excavated there. So there's actually been relatively little excavation at Konya Genç compared to the other two sites, which really have had really substantial, great excavations done. So we'll just look at the minaret of Mamun, which was excavated in the 50s. There's this quite funky picture I managed to find in one of the volumes they published. Interestingly, they write very little about Konya Genç in the Khwarezmian expedition compared to many of the other sites. I think they maybe weren't so interested in it because it was quite late and they saw it fundamentally as an architectural wonder rather than an archaeological wonder. You can see some of the surviving buildings on the horizon here, minarets, mausolea, things like that. So what they found when they excavated this minaret was that there was actually two phases of it here. So you can see the earlier phase had a plaque on it, which said it was built, I think, in 1011. It collapsed and was then rebuilt with this nice facing above. It's obviously subsequently collapsed again. And the excavators were very keen that the Mongols had toppled it and it had been rebuilt because the style of the reconstruction was sort of post-Mongol thing. Although Mamedov and Muradov, who, as they say, put together a book in 2001, pointed out there was an earthquake in 1208, 1209, and sort of suggested that was actually probably more likely the reason that the minaret collapsed. While they were excavating the minaret, they reported there were lots of bodies. They suggested those would have been victims of the Mongols. I haven't found any more information about those. There's nothing published, there's no sort of trauma or anything on them. So, yeah, who knows? That's to be explored further if the bodies ever show up. But yeah, that's pretty much the limit really of that specific excavation in terms of what it can tell us about the Mohmark quest. But we do have some really nice standing buildings, including the Turabo Khanum Mausoleum, which is anyone who's interested in Islamic art history, architecture, I'm sure will know about this amazing building. It's absolutely beautiful tile work, which has survived all the way from the 14th century until today, especially on the inside dome. My slightly dodgy picture of, but you can get the sense of it. So this mausoleum was probably constructed around 1370. There's an article I think in Mykines by Golombek that suggests it may be a bit later, which also seems to me quite plausible actually. So it may be the tail end of the Mongol period or into the kind of Timurid period. There's a sort of slight independent city-state situation going on in between those two. But it really demonstrates the sort of return of monumental architecture. You know, this place is not doing badly under the Mongols. In fact, it's doing brilliantly well. It's got lots of investment in its defenses, so Tash Pala is refortified. The buildings like this that are really cutting edge and really expensive are being constructed. And this is becoming part of a network that is probably a trade network spanning across the Golden Horde territories. If you remember, that was the one that spread from the sort of northern part of the Black Sea through Russia and over to the Aral Sea. And this caravanserai was excavated. So you can see it's not far from the minaret here. It's still in Tashkala, that real central part of the city. And this is a photo from the 50s showing its sort of survival, the survival of its monumental arch. And this is a photo from 10, 15 years ago or something that I took of the decoration inside it. And there were tiles found with a date. I'm trying to remember exactly what the date was because my notes have disappeared. Oh, I've written it here, brilliant. 1363 to 64, so 765 Hijri. And those, you know, it shows that in that, you know, I suppose part, later part of the, that sort of century after the Mongols, that really there is again this monumental investment. And just to sort of remind us where we are, so we had that Konya Urganish is here in the very end of the Golden Horde, and you can kind of see the territories that the Golden Horde has. Konya Urganish is going to be really important to link it into its sort of neighbor khanates and those really different cultures, if you like, and economic opportunities that you get when you come into Iran and Central Asia. The Ilkhanate, center of power, is over here. Merv is right on the border, so you can see why it might be in decline. And I suppose Otrar is potentially useful for the Chagatai Khanate to get access into Transoxiana and Iran. So I think I'm just about done, but I do have something on the water. So if we're happy, I might do another 5 minutes. Because Otrar, I'm going to go back to Otrar. I mentioned the water and the canals earlier and that interesting paper from 2020. And one of the things that I've been working on alongside the excavations at Otrar has been looking at the canals with colleagues Willem Toonen, Mark Macklin, and James Thomas to look at the canals that, you know, from this aerial photograph from the 1960s, you can see are just astonishingly complex irrigation networks. So you've got these canals and then these field systems. And one of the things, one of the questions, obviously, in the Mongol conquest in Central Asia is its reliance on irrigation networks and the narratives that often surround the destruction of these or the cutting off of these or the flooding of cities and things like that. So it's not going to be all about the Mongols, but I'm just going to show you a little bit of a taste of what we've been doing there. So this is Ojrar is the blue star here, the one in the middle here. And these red sites are in a database of the Central Asian Archaeological Landscapes Project, CAL project, at UCL. And they very kindly let us share with us some of their data. And we did a sort of case study on these darker red ones here. And you might expect in that Mongol conquest period for there to be a kind of abandonment of sites. So we put together start dates and end dates for the occupations of these sites. And I've made this graph from it across the oasis. So we've got 65 active sites across the oasis, and most of them are kind of small towns, villages, things like that. I mean, Otra's pretty exceptional, as you might imagine, but there are a lot of substantial settlements there. But actually, the big drop-off seems to be sometime between the 8th and the 9th century. So you think about the Arab conquest, perhaps, but equally you think about the fact that glazed pottery arrives. And if people are doing a quick assessment, they might go, "Oh, no, glazed pottery will put it in this century, glazed pottery will put it in this one." I'm not really sure. But interestingly, in the oasis, the number of sites actually starts to grow again, having been sort of in steady decline in that 13th and 14th century period, which I think is actually quite interesting. And we're working on the surface areas of them, but what looks like the trend is here is actually people are leaving smaller, perhaps less viable sites and moving to bigger ones. But then we get the trend sort of very briefly in the 14th century returning and then dropping off again. And here's just some photos from this is Mark Macklin and my colleague Sarah Appelberg, who works at the Otra State Archaeological Museum and Archaeo Service. And he's been excavating these canals around the oasis, and we've also been excavating some of our own. And Mark has been taking these OSL samples, and we're getting them processed much along the methodology that they used for that paper in 2020. So looking at when the silt was forming in the bottom of these canals, i.e. their last use, and then doing optically stimulated luminescence on them in order to find when the sun last hit, if you like. So that tells you when the canals were abandoned. And just to point out how this works, and there's the River Aras here, the tributary, that's the Syrdarya winding along here. And Otrar is in an enormously convenient place on this high spur of land where you can get canals along, but you can also get the water down into your fields to irrigate them. So this is a really favourable location and probably why Otrar survived the longest, but you can see on all the little spurs of land, settlements are clustering. And basically, what we start to see when we map the canals was that the offtake to Otrar during the from about the 12th century starts to move progressively upstream up here. So instead of taking the water from here and directing it straightly there, they start to take it from higher and higher upstream. And that seems to be some kind of disruption in the overall water supply. So whether that's a climatic thing, whether that's a man-made problem, people are using too much of it, is unclear to us at the moment, but we're doing some modelling to try and find out. We've also done some mapping of the canals inside the city and excavating trenches through them. These seem to be the main feeder canals into each suburb. And as I mentioned, those are the reservoirs. And I'm just going to finally end with this. So we've got a Mongol date, which might help us understand a bit better what's going on, and there's more dates I hope coming from this canal right up in the north of the city. So that's the main feeder canal, and it comes around. This was probably an agricultural area here. So we have the two cuts of the canal down here. This is a kind of recut, and then the shape of the canal changes, if you can see. And I managed to get seeds from the bottom two cuts. So there's effectively a drying up episode, the canal is recut, and then it dries up again. So I wanted to know what was going on. But this phase is not part of a major remodeling, which happens in the middle cut zone. And interestingly, the dates of them came up smack bang in the 13th century and worked quite well as silting up during that 13th century Mongol period. But then actually a recut and another silting up during the Mongols period. So there does seem to be some kind of decline in the irrigation systems. But again, is that because of demographic change? There aren't enough people to clear them out. There's a lot of silt coming down, so it might have to do with that. It doesn't look like this canal network has been intentionally disrupted. It looks like it's still working, which is interesting. And then, of course, there's the role of climate, where one of my amazing undergraduate students at Cambridge, Trinity Benstock, has been working on for her undergraduate dissertation all the proxies for climate across Central Asia heroically. And you can kind of see there's a bit of a shift from the cold to the warm. And then it starts shifting again in that 13th century. So there might be something in there. And the PNAS paper was also quite keen on climate having some kind of effect, but as yet unclear. So I'm just going to conclude there. So just to say that hopefully I've convinced you that with careful excavation and analysis, it is possible to find that archaeological data which can complement the historical discussions. Ottawa, complicated because they're big, complicated cities, but I think also they're complicating that picture of that massive destruction narrative and really highlight that abandonment or depopulation in the 12th century. Koyogenj, underexplored. It would be great if there were more excavations there. It'd be fantastic to find out more about this period in particular, the 12th, 13th into the 14th century. But there's lots of signs of Golden Horde Mongol investment there. And little archaeological evidence of destruction, but again, we might find that if we keep looking. And yeah, there's still lots to do. So with that, I'll thank all my collaborators and all my funders, particularly BIPs, who've been enormously generous. So thank you very much. I think there's time for questions.
Yeah, thank you so much, Katie. Really interesting. And yeah, I think you've definitely shown the importance of archaeological research and how much there is out there still to discover. So yeah, if anyone has questions, please do write them in the Q&A section down at the bottom of the screen. And we've already got a few questions, Katie, so I'll
Right.
read some out and we'll see how many we can get through. Hopefully we can get through a fair number. Someone's asked whether you think the history of these cities might go as far back as the Neolithic age. I don't know if you can tell
Oh
that.
yeah, good question. I think, I mean, there's quite a difference between Khorasan in terms of the age of the earliest settlements and Otrar, the Otrar Oasis, the southern Kazakhstan. There are Neolithic settlements. I don't know if you want to call them towns or cities or probably large villages, maybe very small towns, in Khorasan. So around Ashgabat, for example, there's a site called Jeytun, which people have been excavating even last time in the 90s, maybe, but then there may be more stuff by Tetman teams, but I know there was an international project there. In terms of MERV, I think the earliest attested evidence we have is sometime in the mid first millennium BC, so that kind of Achaemenid expansion period. Otrar is later, and we think that's because it was a inland delta, so it was very marshy and flooded, and actually it needed to drain slightly before the cities could emerge. So yeah, great question. In Khorasan, yeah, I think there is the start of Neolithic, not urbanism, but the start of dense settlements. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess then sort of following on from that and thinking about that time of the Mongol invasion, do we know roughly what kind of population size these sites would have had?
Yeah, that's difficult to know. I think I've seen wildly varying estimates for Otrar from kind of tens of thousands right up to kind of hundreds. I
Okay, that's a
think,
big difference.
I mean, Merv was probably at one point in the 12th century, 100,000 plus, perhaps. It's just such a massive and densely occupied city. I think the other thing we've got to remember on this front is that the cities are obviously the sedentary population, but there was a large kind of mobile population in and around. And I wonder sometimes if these large walled rabats in the suburbs would have been to bring in people maybe seasonally, maybe at times of danger, things like that. So population maybe wasn't always like set.
Yes.
But yeah, I think we're talking probably tens of thousands, maybe 10,000, 20,000, something like that for something like Otrar, but bigger for the really large cities like Merv, I think. But
That's thank
yeah,
you. That's
hard to say.
yeah, it is difficult, isn't it, to tell with for certain. And then someone else got quite a long question, that's why I'm just appearing at my screen. Thanking you very much for your talk and laying out the state of archaeological research on these sites. And the questioner is saying, thinking bigger picture, Peter Christensen argued 30 years ago that the Mongol destruction in Central Asia was greatly exaggerated in the sources, and that the demographic decline and abandonment of the region, urban abandonment, had maybe more to do with agricultural collapse. And he blamed degradation and salinization of the soil. Does the archaeological record help us understand anything more about that salinization or agricultural degradation that might have been going on?
That's a really great question. Thanks for that. Yes, as you can probably guess, I'm suspicious of the demographies in advance of the Mongol conquest. I think there is something going on that's weakening this region, certainly Central Asia. I think other parts of Iran and the Caucasus is a different story, but this sort of central part of Central Asia is appears to be struggling to some extent, with the exception of maybe Urganch, Konya-Urganch, and maybe Dayestan, which is further south. The agricultural side of things is also one I've been trying to better understand. And the salination, I think you are definitely onto something there, because my Kazakh colleagues, the picture I showed of the kind of canals, the really intensive canals in a fan, they are suspicious that they actually are not all flowing at the same time. So they might use an area until it becomes too saline, and then shift the water onto a new area and effectively do themselves out of fertile land over time. My colleague James Thomas has been trying to look at salination. So he got a sort of salt monitor. And when I was excavating, he was testing the different like silt layers in the canal to see if we could date them. But I'm not sure his results actually came to much in the end. It's so salty now, there wasn't actually that significant a variation, and they struggle with it today. So yeah, to be
Great.
continued.
Thank you very much. Now we have a really, I think this is a really interesting question. When we're thinking about these canals and thinking about the water sort of supply and the spread, the distribution of water throughout the archaeological research that you're doing, is there any evidence of gardens? I think that's a lovely question.
Oh yeah, great question. Yeah, I suppose it depends what you mean by garden.
In the question, it is put in quote marks, actually.
Okay. I think so. I've just started doing some palynological studies at Otrar, and there's quite a lot of fruit that seems to be growing in the suburban areas. That's probably not massively surprising, but I guess there would be kind of agricultural gardens in and around the city. And I think there's historical kind of evidence for that, if I remember. Merv is an interesting one, actually, because Galina Pugachenkova, the great archaeologist, architectural historian, everything person for Central Asia, identified what she thought was a sort of pleasure garden zone outside of Merv to the south, which wouldn't be that far from the Buddhist temple. And she initially thought it was Mongol, and then she revised her thinking to thinking that it was Timurid. And there's something that when I was at Merv was always known as the Timurid Pavilion, which was thought to be a kind of pleasure pavilion outside of the city. and it was near kind of ice hazards and stuff. So I think that would be the closest to a kind of formal pleasure garden as opposed to a sort of agricultural garden. And I think the agricultural gardens are probably all over the suburbs and probably
Yes.
old. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I think probably what time just for one last question. Is that okay, Katie? Just one quick one.
Great.
Someone's just asked, what kinds of seeds were they that you found in the waterway in Otrar?
Oh, hang on 1 second. I've got this note in case someone asked me.
Yeah.
Where is it? They are tuber of Phragmites, so they are reed tubers. So that's probably not surprising that they were reed tubers. But we get a lot of in the houses, we get all sorts. I mean, stores of wheat, stores of barley, stores of millet, stores of what I had once hoped was buckwheat, but maybe something a bit more complicated. And yeah, there was a master's student last year at Cambridge who did her master's thesis on the seeds. And yeah, mostly the kind of wheat, barley, millet that would probably would not be a huge surprise, but I suspect if we looked at it more closely, we'd find all sorts of interesting stuff, to be honest. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We've got several people have also just said, not really questions, but just saying thank you so much. Big fun. Thank you very much. Very interesting. So lots of interest in your talk, Katie, and I found it fascinating because it's such a different field from my own. So it's been enormously educative. And thank you so much for giving your time to give this BIPS webinar.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been fantastic, and hope to see you at other, see, you know, everyone who's come to listen to Katie today, hope to see you at future events and dip into other kinds of topics as well. And Katie, obviously you're welcome to attend and watch webinars in the future. So thank you, everyone. I hope everyone has a good rest of their day, wherever you are in the world. Thank you very much, and goodbye, Katie.
Thank you. Bye.